It's good to see you this morning. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. This is a very monumental, if you will, pivotal part of the Bible. And that is because it's a time of which the Israelites had gone through 450 years of not having a king. 450 years. And someone says, well, what's the big deal? Evidently, God said it shouldn't be. It should not be a big deal. But the Israelites, they made it a big deal. And so they were under a succession of judges, as we talked about the last two sermons. A judge was a deliverer, not a judge like you have today, someone who makes a decision in a court of law. But a judge is a deliverer. He would sort of typically, or she, be a captain of the army that would lead the way, that would go out and confront the oppressors. That is to defeat the enemy so that the Israelites might have rest. That's what judges were about. And so when you see in 1 Samuel chapter 8, Samuel is getting old. He's about to pass away. And the Israelites, they come to Samuel and they say, it's time now for kings. So hence the title of the sermon, give us a king to judge us like all the nations. So they did not want this method of leadership that they had known for 450 years. They wanted a new method of leadership. But because of their expression, we'll learn two lessons from this morning. We start in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Samuel was told that he made his sons judges over Israel, the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. I said two different points I want to make today. One of which is they said, we want to be like the nations. There in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 5, raise us up a king so that we might be like all the other nations. I call this peer pressure. Peer pressure is powerful. Peer pressure is an effective tool of Satan. Peer pressure is why a lot of people just kind of go with the flow. People who will say, I want to see which way the wind's blowing, then I want to fit in. That's peer pressure. Peer pressure causes people to look like they look, either their hair, their apparel, their clothing. Sometimes it even is contagious in regard to expressions, things which are catchphrase. When, for instance, somebody says something's cool, you'll say, well, that's from the 60s. That's no longer what you say. Now today, something's bad. You know, something's bad means that something's good. And so you hear all these things, and people, they kind of flow into this, and all of a sudden you're saying, wait, what is the language that we're speaking? Well, whatever the peers are speaking, that's what we're going to speak. Because we want to be in vogue. Everything needs to be in vogue. And so in the world, it's so easy. And I always think about my tombstone. Right there on my grave, if it said, here lies Carl, who was a master conformist. In other words, he always conformed with his peers. That's not really a compliment. And so the idea of us wanting to be like a world that is about us, which doesn't like God, that seems to me just contradictory, just to say it. For us to want to be like the world who doesn't like God, so that we fit in. And someone says, why are people doing that? And so you find out what they wear, maybe how they've decorated their body, and you're saying, what's with that? And then you see some of the associations that they have around them and say, oh, that fits in perfectly. And so you can see that in different groups of people. And you're saying, why do people cave into that? Why are they so pressured to behave like their peers? It's a very effective tool of Satan. Satan was doing that. I believe it's this. Oftentimes we see that it's easier to get along than it is to fight against. It's easier to switch than it is to fight. That's the concept. And so, but with these Israelites, I believe that they wanted what was being accepted, what was being participated in and enjoyed by their neighboring nations. And they said, we need to have the same type of governmental structure that the neighbors have so that we can accomplish the same things that they're getting. They were bored with God. They said, give us a different system. We want something else. It's just not quite right. Sometimes people don't know what they want, but they know what they don't want. And so they just keep switching around. And they say, well, that's still not what I want. They just keep switching around. But they'll look to see what others are doing. What are others doing? I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it on. I want to go back to the expression. Why would we want so mightily to try to get along with people who don't like God? With people who don't like God. It just doesn't seem right. It's not right. And so sinners do entice. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1. The Proverbs of Solomon. Of course, Solomon had lived, and Solomon is instructing by his wisdom the power of peer pressure. Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8, he says, my son, hear the instruction of your father. Verse 8, he says, and do not forsake the law of your mother, for they will be a graceful ornament on your head and chains about your neck. So the first thing of which he introduces this with in verse 8 is to say, you need to know the wisdom that comes from your parents. That's what you need to know. And someone says, parents are square. My thought is this, that the first 12 years of your life, you embarrass your parents, okay? But they're going to go ahead and keep you the first 12 years of your life. The next 12 years, and maybe even the rest of your life, your parents embarrass you. So you're thinking, parents don't know anything. You know, parents are square. That's another word from the 60s. I'm sorry, but parents are, you know, just odd. Parents are very odd. I want to fit in with others who are 13, others who are 21. I want to fit in with 31 years old. And he's saying this. He says, this is what you want to do. You want to please the Lord, you want to please your parents. That's what you want to do and honor them. Forget the rest of the world. Forget your peers. Dare to be different. Then in verse 10, he says, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse. So not only are we blending ourselves together, but we've become somewhat of a gang. He says we've even pooled our resources. We all have one treasury. That's how life is moving along. He's describing peer pressure. The very opening statement in verse 10, my son, if sinners entice you, that's pulling you in. You're saying peer pressure is something that I pick and choose, but he says, no, it's powerful, it's persuasive, and then it's destructive. Later, he says that they run quickly and make haste to their own destruction. When we read in verse 15, he says, my son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They lurk secretly for their own lives, so are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owner. Owners, plural. Here's a concept. If we are caving into peer pressure, what it says is this: you've accomplished nothing and you've destroyed plenty. Peer pressure. Trying to conform with those around us, looking at the way of others and saying that's to be our pattern. So we discuss this, and in the New Testament, we see a couple of statements, simple statements, if you will, in Romans chapter 12. In Romans chapter 12, he's talking simply to the Christian. When he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service, and do not be conformed. That means there in verse 2, don't cave in to peer pressure. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So I say this, that when it comes to peer pressure, it reflects sometimes in what we wear and some of the behaviors of, you know, our expressions, verbal expressions. But it then goes into different stages of morality. And someone says, you need to get along. You hear such statements as, don't ever trust a man that doesn't drink. You ever hear that statement? I hope you haven't. But I've heard that statement. That's peer pressure. That's to say, don't do business with someone that doesn't drink. That's peer pressure for me to want to drink just simply so that I conform to those who are around me. Peer pressure is where we're told that if we don't get along with the team, then we're going to be left out or we're going to be causing problems, and I've got to be my own man. In business and in government work, of which I've done, to be a team player to me is important. But what it involves me compromising my honesty, compromising my integrity, and then being at risk as far as taking a bribe or something that could be sensed as that which is not ethical. And I would rather use the word moral. But when I say I'm not going to go along with that, it puts off quite a few folks. It does put off quite a few folks. But the peer pressure is so strong today. It's strong in personal lives. It's strong in family lives. It's strong in government. A lot of people in government have found that they've gone along with things they never would have gone along with because they are wanting to be a team player. Sometimes it's important to stand up and to be the only person that's standing up with the Lord and for the Lord. It's important to be your own person. When we talk about morality, peer pressure can get things affected that we can't get even as preachers. I'll give you an example. Back in the 1960s, it was very popular for women to wear very tight, very short clothing. And so the thought was this. Finally, there came along the style of which the hemlines dropped and everything looked and appeared to be godly. That it advertised the faith and the image of God more so than the flesh. And so somebody remarked and observed that in one day that the fashion designers had lowered the hemline, whereas decades of preaching couldn't get it done. That's peer pressure. And we might say that's peer pressure for a positive reason, but that wasn't the motive behind what they're doing. They're trying to sell clothes, right? They're trying to sell clothes. I'm trying to convince you of how powerful peer pressure is. Peer pressure can even get people to do the right thing just because they're fitting in, even to do the right thing. So what we come back to is us asking ourselves, why are we doing what we're doing? Are we doing it so that we can please men, that we can please people that don't like God? Or are we doing it because we're going to please God? So I applied that to morals. Some peer pressure today would even put children, teenagers down because they have not risked life itself. Some peer pressure today, in other words, do something so dangerous that it's going to cost you your life. Some peer pressure today would tell children that they need to defile themselves in a relationship that's immoral. And if you haven't, you're being put down because of that. Whereas others who practice abstinence and want to keep themselves for marriage, they are being put down. They're being shamed. That's peer pressure. Peer pressure to do what's wrong. When he says, be not conformed to this world, but transform. Transform means that you are standing out and willing to be yourself in the face of peer pressure. This is a big problem. That's what swept the Israelites into saying we want a king. Now we talk about religion. Today, when it comes to peer pressure sometimes wants us to measure up to the expectations of the denominational world around us. And that is we have huge edifices or that we have a clergy which is well-educated and we can tell where people got their degrees from. And there's a peer pressure to do that. A peer pressure to say, you know, what programs are your church involved? And we compare ourselves again to others who practice something called Christianity. And then we're trying to show that we can compete in that arena. I had a brother in Christ one time, and I think he was sincere, and I don't think he was filled with any kind of malice, but he says, what does your church have to offer us? And I said, if you're going to make us compete on the grounds of what we accomplish in comparison to what others are doing, I'm not going to enter that competition. I'm not going to enter that competition. Here's what I will do. I will say, what does the Lord want us to do? And I don't want to be left out in any regard. And what the Lord wants us to do in serving others, I don't want to be left out in any regard. I won't take a back seat. Here in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, when he says, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. He says, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Let me tell you, we're not approved because we're not getting sucked in by our peers. That's not what approves us. And someone says, well, at least I didn't live like the world around me. I was different. We're not approved just because we're different. Someone says, well, we're not a denomination. They never got me into the denominations. I went to my grave, but never did I go to the denomination. Let me tell you, we're not approved because we're not a denomination. We're not approved because of that of which we're in deference to which we're in deference. We're approved because of what we're in relationship to. That's what approves us. That you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So I like to say it this. I sort of like to speak simplistically, and that is, I need to compare myself to God rather than comparing myself to others to get my justification. So I'm not going to be justified because I've compared myself to others, and I say, well, at least I'm not like them. I'm going to be justified because I compared myself to God. That's the simplest way of which I can say it. Compare yourself to God. Prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. That's where you find justification. That's where you find true identity. That's an identity that's not a fad. When we talked about morals, Brother Melvin Curry, who was in town the last couple of weeks and sadly had to spend time in the hospital. He's a preacher and also a retired Bible professor at Florida College. But he was saying that when it came to the subject of homosexuality or this idea of being gay, he says it's sort of a fad. It's a fad. Peer pressure is making people pose a strong self-identity. They need something that's radical, something that sounds and looks very powerful. So that's why you have people that are not only, you know, older teenagers, but even younger teenagers, maybe someone that's what they call a tween. They're saying, well, I'm going to come out that my gender has changed. And you're saying, why? Peer pressure. Peer pressure. That's wherein lies some strength today. And someone says, I couldn't find any strength in some strong identity and, you know, what I was birthed as and what I was identified by my parents as, so I'm going to radically change. That's peer pressure. It is. And so when people are swept into this, it's a matter of following a trend, a fad. 1 John chapter 2, when he talks about those kinds of things that seem so powerful at the time, and you're thinking, okay, what's your haircut going to be today? What's it going to be tomorrow? What's your clothing going to be today, tomorrow? Your shoes. And you're saying, well, I'll just wait and see what the trend is. I got to stay glued to the trend. So it says on my epitaph, you know, right there on my grave marker, he always conformed. He stayed right with it. Now, we're not trying to do that. When he says, do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the world or is not of the Father, but it is of the world. Let me read that again, verse 16. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. If we look at those three different ideas, what he says, the lust of the flesh, that's those who say that you must behave like the world around you, whatever your flesh desires. Or it might be what your acquaintance's flesh desires, that you're saying, well, that's what I'm going to identify with. The lust of the eyes, that is that I can have whatever I want to have, material things. Why do I need to have that? It's, as the old expression goes, keeping up with the Joneses. Keeping up with the Joneses. I'm doing that. And then he says the pride of life. Once again, a lot of things that people came into just so that I could feel proud about myself. I feel important. Very important. But he says, is not of the Father, but is of the world. But this verse 17, the world is passing away and the lust of it. So a lot of decisions I made 20 years ago, 40 years ago, a lot of those decisions I made at that time, I see that what I thought was important at that time aren't. They were just cultural. They were related to the times in which I lived. The important decisions that I should have made at that time was that I'm going to walk with God, relate to God, who is eternal, so that I have eternal life with him. And the rest of it is the small stuff. The small stuff. I sometimes talk about trying to stay in fashion. My expression is this: a good sermon can overcome a bad suit, okay? And so you're thinking, so what if you don't keep up with the times? And I've known preachers that just outright clash. And we try not to do that, but sometimes, you know, that's what's available. The idea is this: what's important is who we are from the inside out. What's important is the foundation upon which we anchor ourselves, the morals of which we are riveted to, of which we will not vary, of which we will not sway, because that is who God is. Because in the end, all these things of the earth, they're going to pass away. God is eternal, and those that walk with God will be with him eternally. That's strong. Don't you just love people, though, that sometimes stick out for the right reasons? For the right reasons, not for the wrong reasons, for the right reasons. This was the big problem. This is where Israel was, and we've spent a lot of time on this. Let's touch on another component of this same verse. And that is, give us a king to judge us like all the nations. Give us a king. Give us a king. The Israelites liked the king concept. They wanted a king. They wanted a different government. Kings in that time were sometimes just a city king. We would call that a mayor today. Could be a regional king. We might call that a governor. Could be a national king. We could call that a president or king. Could be an international king, of which we would call an emperor. They said, we love this concept. We love this concept. But God has said from the get-go, he says, I'm going to be your king. I'm going to be your king. Notice this, that the Lord said to Samuel, they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. A lot of different ways in which God has reigned over his people, and we'll go ahead and put that up. When it comes to God, he used different administrations. He used the patriarchal, he used the mosaical, that should be capital M, a mosaical. He used Christ's dispensation. When God rules, he can use any combination. So God did rule at the early time with the patriarchal. He just left it up to the father of each house to say, this is what's going to happen to this house. So God had voiced through prophets his will, and the parents in that house would say, we will instruct. We will instruct. So when somebody got in trouble in the community, the first people they answered to was their parents. Sort of like mom. When she said, you go to school, you get in trouble, you come home and you're in twice that amount of trouble with me. Okay, that's how parents rule. Parents rule. So somebody says, "Well, you know, you get in trouble. We're not going to tell on you, and you already are in trouble." First, let me tell you, with yourself. That's who you're in trouble with, is first yourself, and then whoever else finds out about it. But back in the patriarchal days, you would have been in trouble with your parents, and they would have and could have even delivered you up to be executed. Your parents would have seen that the right thing was done. And when the right thing was done, just like Eli the judge, if you want to read 1 Samuel chapters 2 and 3, chapters 2 and 3, you see that when his sons died, that he didn't have any grudge against God because of what they had done. That was an abomination to God. And the same was true with Aaron, with his two sons in Leviticus chapter 10. When they were struck dead by God, he didn't have any disapproval of what God had done to his own two sons. The patriarchal system worked. The mosaical system is where Moses was the leader. You know, when people disagreed, when they had a problem with God, you know who they took it out on? Moses. They took it out on God, on Moses, when really their grief was against God. When Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, Numbers chapter 16, challenged Moses and said, we don't think things are going too good. You need some help. What God did was he opened up the earth and it swallowed those people and their families, okay? Because really, they didn't have a problem with Moses. What they had a problem with was God. They had a problem with God. God's means of ruling people is not really a problem. The problem is with God. When people say we reject God, who do they usually take it out on? The representatives of God. Whether it be parents, whether it be Moses, whether it be Samuel, who was a judge, of which God had raised up, and they said, we don't want to have judges. We want to have a king. We don't like your method. What they really have an issue with is that. So I did put up on the board Isaiah chapter 66. So I put this in reverse just a little bit, but look at Isaiah chapter 66. in this passage of which is established, and I think Isaiah the prophet, as he is, I believe, the longest book in the Old Testament, not the oldest, but the longest, when he says, "Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool." So, during the course of time, whether it be the parents who are in charge of children, whether it be Moses, who's leading the Israelites like a shepherd, whether it be Samuel as a judge, whether it be kings, and he gave them kings, kings that ruled over cities, kings that ruled over regions, nations, God gave kings. Regardless of that, they are just instruments of God. That's all they are. Who is actually ruling? Who is ruling? Who is ruling is God. But God used different administrations. God is ruling. Should not make any difference in the world. By the way, the same people that said these judges aren't cutting it, when they had kings, guess what? Same thing. Same behavior, same people. Kings that came from a moral citizenship, an immoral citizenship, were immoral. That's what it amounted to. We need to get righteous leaders in this country. I once asked an older preacher, and always looking for that older preacher to get the right answers from. I said, "Why is it that we don't have more people qualified to serve as elders in the church?" And he says, "It's because we don't have more people qualified to be Christians in the church." I thought that was profound. In order for us to have people qualified to be elders, we have to have people qualified to be Christians. In order for us to have people qualified to be leaders in our country, we have to have citizens that are of high moral character. And when people have a heart to do everything that they can get away with and then put from that pool leadership, it's not going to be good. We need to work on ourselves, not just work on the leaders. We need to work on ourselves. And that's in the church and Christianity, that's in our communities, our nation, everything. I know that sounded a little preachy, but I'm preaching. All right. Look at what God has done. God has returned all men to God as king. In this case, Christ. Christ who is of the God family. Look at what God has done. So when Samuel was speaking, it's approximately 1,080 years, something like that, 1,080 years, that they get their first king, Saul. They get their king. And then they get a subsequent king, David, then Solomon, and so forth. They get their kings. But really, all along the way, we see where God is king. All of these individuals, David and Saul, were said to have sat on God's throne. Whose throne is it? God says, "Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool." It belongs to God. It is God's throne. But look in Acts chapter 2 and verses 34 through 36. David's point is this, that God is our king. When he refers to Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, and the fact that Jesus is our Savior, he makes a side point in verse 34, "For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he says himself, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool.'" He says he's raising the descendant of David, who is a Lord divine. That word Lord there is from Yahweh, or from the idea of one who is divine. He says David's descendant, who is divine, will be raised up and he will reign. He will be on the throne. He will make all his enemies his footstool. That is, God is king. God is king. That's the theme here. God is king. And then you read there in verse 36, "Therefore let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." So our king is God now. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 19 through 23. Again, a statement which shows the divinity of Jesus, but it also shows that he is king. He says, "And what is the exceeding greatness of his power toward us who believe? According to the working of his mighty power, which he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places." That means he's king. He says he's far above all principality and power and might and dominion in every name that is named, and not only in this age, but also in that which is to come. "And he put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all." Jesus is He's the King of Kings. He's the Lord of Lords. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 16. So when you have Lord of Lords and King of Kings, what it means is this. Our King is God. Our King is God. I just like this. The book ends. Here you have on this hand, in the time of Samuel, you have these people saying, we want to have a king. And God says, no, I'm your king. I want to be your king. Then you have over 1,000 years later when Jesus comes, you have God saying, see there, Jesus is king. Told you I could do it this way. Told you I could do it this way. There are still earthly kings, and Jesus made a difference between Caesar's kingdom and God's kingdom. There is a distinction, but Caesar's kingdom is under God's kingdom, but there is a distinction. Jesus is the king of our hearts. That's what Jesus is the king of. It's not dictated by geographical boundaries. It doesn't have to do with any type of capital city, those kinds of things. It has to do with Jesus ruling in heaven. He's on the throne, and he rules my heart. Jesus is king. You see where God is now ruling us through God. God is now ruling us through God. When they said to Samuel, these Israelites, make us a king so that we can be judged like all the nations. When they said that, you can see where that was just like a spear, you know, through Samuel's heart. But you can see more so, it was like a spear through the heart of God. A spear through the heart of God. If we today serve God through his son Jesus Christ, these two points of which we've made would not be a problem. We will not succumb to peer pressure, but we will stand individually. We will stand happily, unashamed with Christ in this world. The second thing is we submit to him as our king. We know that regardless of what human supervisors are appointed over us, that first and foremost, that we have consented to the kingship of Jesus Christ. He is king. I'm through preaching now.